Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Good day and welcome to the 26th presentation by Drinker Biddle inside the Beltway conference call. And at this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Paula, thank you very much. Hello, everybody. As always, we live in interesting times, and I think we have a lot of really valuable information for you today, pretty much across the board, ERISA, SEC, FINRA. But to get the program going, I'm Fred Riche. I'm a partner at Drinker Biddle, and I'm the head of the Financial Services ERISA team. With me, I have Brad Campbell, who is also a partner in a firm located in our Washington, D.C. office. I'm in L.A. And Brad is the former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefits Security Administration. Also with us is a partner from the Chicago office, Jim Lundy. And Jim was previously with the SEC for a number of years in several different capacities and has some valuable insights in that regard. And then Sandy Granham, a partner in our Florham Park and New York offices, who heads up our broker-dealer team, our FINRA team. So that's the group that's here. In addition, from Drinker Biddle, in addition, we have Jim Dolan, who's the Vice President of Retirement Strategies at Natixis Investment Managers. And I'll get back to Jim in a minute. But first, let me just let you all know, this presentation is being recorded. And it takes us a couple of days to get it up and posted. But a few days from now, it will be posted at www.drinkerbiddle.com under a tab called Insights and Events. At some level, don't even worry about that, because everybody who registered for the program will get an email once it's posted with a link. And you can just go to it there and share it with your compatriots. Feel free to let others listen to it who you think might be interested. Now back to Jim Dolan. As you all know, if you've listened to these programs in the past, Natixis has enabled us to bring them to you. And we appreciate that very much. It's been a great partnership with Jim specifically and with Natixis generally. With that introduction, Jim, let me turn it over to you for a minute.
Fred, thanks so much. I appreciate the partnership. It's been great. I think we've been doing this for about 6.5 years. I believe this is our 26th session, so it's been going great, and certainly today is a timely call. I want to thank everyone for calling in today and taking time out of their day to join us, and I want to thank Drinker Biddle again for the partnership. This really is great. And for those of you who don't know Natixis Investment Managers, we are a multi-affiliate organization with 26 investment managers worldwide. We apply active thinking to deliver solutions to the marketplace to provide great investments really in all market environments. I work in our DC business focused on 401ks and retirement assets, and I'm really proud to share with you that we are the only firm that offers an ESG-focused target date mutual fund for investors. We brought that to the marketplace about 2 years ago, and it's a major focus for us, and just wanted to share that with this group. And again, I want to thank everyone for calling in today. And with that, I'll turn it back to you.
Hey, Jim. Thanks, Fred. Thank you very much. And thanks for the partnership on top of that. Well, rather than starting off with the agenda that we sent out to you all, there have been a couple of recent developments that have happened since it last went out. And I want to deal with those first, because I think they're important, but they're relatively short in terms of the presentation. So, I'm going to turn to Brad Campbell and ask him first. Brad, there was a couple days ago the DOL posted its regulatory agenda for the next year. And I think somewhat to people's surprise, there was an agenda item that more or less said that the DOL was going to revisit the regulation under Section 321 of ERISA. That's the definition of fiduciary advice. And the fiduciary prohibited transactions, but then it had a date like September of next year, so a year away. Can you interpret that for us so that we understand what, or at least we think we understand what the DOL was saying?
Yeah, absolutely, Fred. And again, thanks to all of you for taking the time to join us. So within the last 48 hours, they put out the unified regulatory agenda for the federal government. And as Fred said, on the DOL portion, it had this regulation dealing basically the fiduciary rule regulation and the class exemptions with a date of September of 2019 for next action. And really what we think that is a placeholder for future action in response to where the SEC is likely to end up with regulation best interest and the guidance on advice on registered investment advisors. And the reason we think that is right now we're operating in sort of a transitional period. The DOL rule obviously was vacated by the Fifth Circuit. It died this June. We're operating under the 1975 rule, but there's a DOL enforcement policy that's been in place since May 7th. Dealing with potential prohibited transactions that might result from the elimination of the best interest contract exemption. And so what we're expecting to happen is that DOL is going to need to wrap this up with a new sort of broad-based class exemption and potentially some changes to perhaps with rollovers, we're not quite sure, but most likely a class exemption in the future that takes into account what the SEC is going to do and says that for DOL's purposes in prohibited transactions, that when you're giving advice to a plan or an IRA, that certain types of compensation are okay, are exempted from the prohibited transaction rules, provided you either comply with whatever conditions DOL is going to propose or whatever conditions the SEC has put in place, for example, in the final version of Regulation Best Interest. And one of the things that suggests that they're tying these together is that if you look at the agenda, it also shows the SEC as completing its work on the final Regulation Best Interest, the final guidance, the form CRS, all of those being completed in September of 19 as well. So that's a pretty good signal that what we're looking at is DOL and SEC trying to end up in the same place at the same time with complementary regulation. That just to be clear, though, we don't really know. The description is very vague, but that's the most likely explanation.
Well, Brad, there's nothing better than an educated rumor, so thank you very much. let's go on to the next one, which is that news reports came out this morning that the Office of Management and Budget has finalized its review of the DOL proposal on open multiple employer plans, or open MEPs. Can you sort of fill that in a little bit? That's a pretty broad statement, but what do you think it means?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a great example. Normally, regulatory time and geologic time have a lot in common in terms of being slow-moving and having a really long time horizon. The exception to that is when President Trump puts out an executive order that directs an agency to do something. And on August 31st, President Trump put out an executive order that told DOL, hey, you guys are going to create association retirement plans, which is essentially open MEPs. So you DOL are going to change whatever positions you've had in the past to facilitate these, and that's what you're being told to do. So that came out August 31st. By September, I think it was 25th, but before the end of September, DOL had sent to OMB a regulation as a result of that executive order, and now we know OMB has cleared it. To put this in perspective, when I was running the agency, OMB usually takes up to 90 days. I don't think I ever had a regulation that took less than 89. But OMB has put out and finalized its review of this DOL regulation in basically 3 weeks. So on the unified agenda that we just discussed, this was also one of the items on there. And the deadline for the next action, which was the proposal of the revised definition of employer, in other words, these association retirement plans or open MEPs, was October of this year, right now. And it does look like they're going to meet that deadline, because if OMB has cleared the regulation, it's usually a few days or a few weeks, can be anywhere up to 2 weeks, before the regulation is published, but publication is imminent. So we're going to see the proposal on open MEPs in the very near future. And I think, Fred, you would agree with me, this is probably one of the more significant changes we're going to see in the retirement space in anytime soon, because it's essentially creating the possibility for a new product, particularly aimed at the smaller plan marketplace. So this is a change that's now happening. It's no longer a pie-in-the-sky discussion. It's actually happening, and we're going to see the regulatory proposal very shortly.
Yeah, I do agree, Brad, and I think what once the guidance is clarified and final, then you're going to have providers put together MEPs, open MEPs, and then advisors are going to have to recommend that plan sponsors adopt them. So, that all happened slower than the few weeks that it took to get this guidance out. But I think that once the pathway is cleared, that the private sector will take over, and I do think that these can be successful, particularly for small employers, because they transfer much of the administrative work, they transfer much of the fiduciary responsibility, and they may reduce costs from the plan because of the group purchasing power of the assets of multiple plans. So,
Fred, it occurs to me, we should probably make sure we're doing a good level set here. The big difference that we anticipate DOL is going to make is that right now, only in rare circumstances, dealing with bona fide trade or professional associations, and there's a whole bunch of detail behind that and several different advisory opinions, it's really hard to make that work. Only in those rare circumstances is a multiple employer plan, one plan with one Form 5500 with one audit for all the participating employers. Currently, most of those are actually 50 different plans with 50 different 5500s and 50 different audit requirements. It's a bunch of plans sharing a common administrative structure. This change, we assume, what DOL is going to propose is to change that so it can be one plan with one plan document covering 50 or however many different employers. So there are real economies of scale potentially available.
Yeah. And one other quick update, and then we'll move back to the agenda that we advertised to y'all. And that is the state of New Jersey has come out and proposed a state fiduciary rule saying that since the DOL rule was vacated and because they don't think that the SEC rule is going to be strong enough, they're effectively proposing to propose a state fiduciary standard that would apply to RIAs and broker-dealers. And it's early in the process. We really don't know what it's going to look like. But I just want you to know that that's happening. And so they're joining New York and Nevada and proposing state fiduciary rules that would put a fiduciary standard on at least some of the advisors in those states. Let's move to the agenda, Brad. You've already really talked about part of it. I was going to ask you about the president's executive order. We've already talked about MEPS, which was a big part of that. And then I want you to sort of segue from that right into tax reform 2.0 and RESA. Maybe highlight a couple of the most important provisions for retirement plans and then give us some sort of prognosis of the future. What do you think the timing is going to be? Do you think we'll actually get some legislation and so on? So, Brad?
Okay. Well, let me do that, but just let me briefly go back to New Jersey. What they put out in their pre-proposal, they didn't give us any new detail we didn't already have, except that they're going to do public hearings on November 2nd and November 19th, and that they're soliciting comments on a very vague pronouncement that they want to do a fiduciary standard for all advisors. And those comments are due by December 14th. So that's moving, it's real, but we still have no useful detail, as Fred said. So now looking at Congress, in terms of the executive order, the president talked about the association retirement plans and that change. The other big component of that, particularly for DOL, was to look at electronic delivery of documents so that we can get away from sort of the default being paper and moving to the default being electronic, I guess I should say. And as part of that, there's a question as to whether DOL will look at reevaluating some of the requirements for participant disclosures. So I wouldn't view this as a wholesale reopening of the 404A5 regulations, but rather a look at electronic disclosure and whether there's some tweaks to make in how those participant disclosures are provided to make them more user-friendly. Interestingly enough, even though that is directed in the executive order, there wasn't anything on the regulatory agenda that just came out specifically related to that. Now, supposedly that's on a slightly slower time frame. Obviously, the Association Retirement Plans or the MEP proposal is on the fast track. it seems that the electronic delivery and participant disclosure part is on a little slower track. But I would still anticipate that that's something that's going to happen, and we'll see, you know, material progress on that in 2019. That was kind of it for the highlights of the DOL regulatory agenda. But looking at Congress, we do have a lot of activity there. As we all know, the first round of tax reform last year, we kind of dodged a bullet. We didn't get mandatory Rothification, so that was a good thing, but we also really got no material reforms. Yes, starting in January of 19, we have changes to the hardship rules, and there's a few other tweaks that came out of last year's tax reform, but nothing really substantive. As Fred said, on this year's retirement reform, we have the RISA bill in the Senate from Senator Hatch, and then in the House we have the Family Savings Act, which is part of Tax Reform 2.0. And in the House, that bill has passed all the way through. And so the situation where we stand is, will the House and Senate do a conference committee to actually pass a tax bill before the end of this Congress, which would be in early January? And if so, what's going to be in it? As the House proceeded, it adopted more and more of the Senate provisions. So we ended up with a House and Senate bill that are relatively close in terms of the broad strokes. They would also facilitate multiple employer plans, open MEPs, and in addition to addressing the issue of whether it's one plan or multiple plans with a common structure, it would also address the so-called one bad apple rule, which would basically say if one of the plans in the MEP, you know, messes up, has, you know, qualification problems, that wouldn't taint the entire program. It would be limited to that one participating employer to resolve those problems. The House bill, unlike the Senate bill, creates this new universal savings account, which is a kind of like a Roth IRA for up to a $2,500 contribution, but without any of the restrictions related to retirement. So it would be essentially an ongoing tax-preferred, albeit Roth-style, tax-preferred vehicle for saving up to $2,500 annually. And using it without, you know, penalties on early withdrawals and so forth. They make a number of other changes to various, you know, testing rules and, you know, some important but minor changes to, you know, the tax code, for example, allowing employers to adopt a qualified plan up to the due date of their tax return instead of only at specified times. And most significantly, the House, in the amendment process, adopted a rule that mirrors where the Senate is, that would say that there would be a safe harbor for selecting lifetime income products like annuities by fiduciaries and plans. So the question is, are the House and Senate going to actually agree on the details and pass a bill before we leave? And the short answer to that is it depends a lot on what happens in the next election. My personal guess for what that's worth is that if Republicans retain the House and Senate both, that probably the impetus to get a bill done before the end of the year isn't there, and we see tax reform become an issue for 2019, retirement plan portion of it as well, as something that carries on to the next Congress. The problem, though, is conventional wisdom suggests that the House is likely to be taken over by the Democrats as a result of the election, while the Senate is likely to stay Republican. I'll leave it to wiser prognosticators to say whether that conventional wisdom is correct. But let's assume for the moment the House does go to the Democrats and the Senate stays with the Republicans. Might that incent the Republicans to get everything they can done before January, when things would become much harder, when the actual changeover in power would occur? And it may well. And then the question there is this one of those things that makes that high priority list? And there's some reason to believe that it might. So I think November 6th is going to determine in some ways whether we have a fast tax bill with retirement provisions or whether we don't. But it's still, again, somewhat hard to predict how all that's going to play out. I guess the message I would take from all this on the tax reform side is we do have some genuinely beneficial provisions that are moving in Congress. Most of them have bipartisan support. So there is a possibility, even if we have sort of mixed governance with two different parties next year, controlling different bodies in the House and Senate, that we may still see some compromise and progress. But it's really hard to predict the tenor of that as we go forward.
Well, thanks, Brad. I think it's particularly interesting that while there's so much fighting going on between the Democrats and the Republicans over tax cuts and who should get the benefit of them, and you know, the stuff that gets the headlines in the newspapers, that we actually work in an area where there's a lot of concurrence and cooperation. That is, in the retirement plan area, I think there's a common perception that, you know, in a 401k, 403b type world, people are on their own to a large degree, and that they need more help. And I think the Republicans and Democrats are both supporting that.
I think that's true. I mean, if you look at Senators Portman and Senators Cardin, who've worked together in the past on these issues, I think they're going to be working together in the future again, regardless of who's controlling which House of Congress. And I think Congressman Neal, the ranking member on the Ways and Means Committee, and Chairman Brady of the Ways and Means Committee, they have a good working relationship. And even though there were some partisan overtones to this recent, you know, the Tax Reform 2.0, as you say, the source of that really wasn't the retirement provisions, it was the other provisions. So there may well be some room for this to work out in the future.
Yeah, I feel very positive about that. And you know, with the aging of the baby boomers and you know, the retirements, the numbers out there, I think we all know, about 10,000 people are reaching age 65 every day, about 10,000 people become eligible for retirement benefits every day, and the numbers are staggering, and then that money has to last for 20 or 30 years in retirement. So there's plenty of issues to work on. Brad, I want to turn, and I'll do a little discussion, but I'd love your comments as I go through this. I'm going to turn to DOL investigations of RIAs and broker-dealers. And what I'm going to do is just give some examples. But you might ask why. Why are we talking about DOL investigations now? When, you know, there's SEC proposals and legislation and so many other things going on. Well, two reasons. One is that I think that the focus of the Department of Labor, now that the fiduciary rule has been vacated, now that there's not as much regulatory or energy going into developing regulations for the most part, I think the focus is going to be on more enforcement. So it is a topical subject in that regard. But more importantly, I think there's been a realization over the years, probably going back to when Brad was there at the Department of Labor, that in the 401k world, the service providers play critical roles in the operation of the plans and the decisions that are made by plans, anywhere from investments to selection of record keepers, maybe even plan design. But they're, unlike defined benefit plans, where a lot of stuff happens in-house, with 401k plans, most of it happens at a provider, or it's materials prepared by a provider, or it's advice given by a provider. So, in fact, there's a national investigatory program on consultants that the DOL is conducting right now, and it is very broad. For example, We were just hired to handle a DOL investigation of a trust company that sets up collective investment trusts and operates them. And in that process, became aware of another DOL investigation of a trust company on similar issues. And in areas you might not expect them. The service providers include record keepers, third-party administrators, banks and trust companies, investment managers, investment advisors, and broker-dealers, at the least. I mean, that's a partial list. And so we're seeing a somewhat more focused DOL investigation program on service providers on some issues you might expect, but you wouldn't expect the facts, or on some issues that you might not even expect. Let me explain. Let me start off with a registered investment advisor firm as an advisor to plans, where they managed accounts. They managed assets and plans, active discretionary management. As a part of that, they custodied the plan's assets with a custodian, and they selected no transaction fee funds. But they also, the RIA firm, also had a deal with a custodian where they received some compensation based on the volume of no transaction fee funds held by the broker-dealer and held by the custodian and advised by the RIA. The DOL investigated, said that's a prohibited transaction. Furthermore, it could be a fiduciary breach. It's a prohibited transaction because the RIA, as a discretionary investment manager, is per se a fiduciary. Remember, the fiduciary rule that got vacated was about non-discretionary investment advice. discretionary investment management is and always has been a fiduciary activity both for plans, participant accounts, and IRAs. There are very few exemptions, for example, the non-enforcement policy that Brad discussed. That doesn't protect prohibited transactions arising from discretionary investment management. It's only non-discretionary investment advice that it applies to. So I think the reason that it's a prohibited transaction is pretty obvious. Plan assets were used by a discretionary fiduciary to get a benefit from the fiduciary. TT, classic definition of a prohibited transaction, but an area where there hasn't been much presence by the DOL in the past. But why would it be a fiduciary breach? Well, the position that the DOL investigator took was that if you're going to hold an asset for a long time, it's cheaper to pay the transaction fee and hold the less expensive share class. On the other hand, if the investment, the mutual fund, say, is only going to be held for a short period of time, then it might be cheaper to do the no transaction fee fund, even though the expense ratio is a little higher, the net total cost is less. So the DOL took the position that the investment advisor had to do that analysis before placing a transaction before placing an order to buy a mutual fund. They had to decide whether it was more cost effective to do NPF or to pay the transaction fee. So that's one, that's a live case. I mean, that is a case that I'm involved in handling. And it's pretty well resolved now, but so I can talk about it, even though I can't mention names. But, Brad, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, or if you've seen any activity like that, or just generally about the DOL focus on service providers.
Well, I would just add that I'm also currently defending a number of service providers in DOL investigations, and mostly they've started with, hello, we're from DOL, show us how you do ERISA. They've been very broad-based investigations into every aspect of the line of business that involves plans, IRAs, and those types of entities. Then it starts drilling down into some of these very narrow focuses. But obviously, the core things that we would expect them to look at, have you made your proper disclosures? Are you actually receiving the fees you said you were supposed to receive? All of those are things they're checking. But they're getting into these more granular and, frankly, more complex interpretations. And I think it reflects some of the experience that they gained throughout this fiduciary rule process. Unfortunately, I would also say I'm not sure it's universally accurately understood. I still, in my own experience, find there's quite a variation between investigators and regional offices in how thorough their understanding is of some of the transactions that they are investigating. And I would just add to it something that we often remind clients when they get a findings letter from a DOL investigation, which is just because DOL has asserted a breach doesn't mean there actually has been one. And we need to sometimes wrestle with them on the allegations they're making and interpretations they're putting forward.
Absolutely. And there are almost always arguments that can be made, either against the fact that it's a breach or a prohibited transaction or to diminish the size of it. So keep that in mind. Brad, let me do one broker-dealer example. And then I think what we ought to do is on all these future Beltway calls, I'm going to have one or two examples and just talk about them so that people can understand the issues that come up. Let me use a broker-dealer example now, and then after that we'll move on to Jim Lundy and the share class selection disclosure initiative. But I'm involved in a case right now, a DOL investigation, but it started with the SEC. The Securities and Exchange Commission examined a broker-dealer, and they found that they were collecting front-end loads on A shares of mutual funds where the prospectuses may have allowed for them to be waived for charitable organizations and retirement funds. And I say may because there were like 20 different prospectuses and they all said different things and some were as confusing as all get out. Anyway, the SEC got in the middle of that and said, wait a second, we're not going to handle this, and they referred the case to FINRA. For FINRA to come in and handle it because FINRA has developed some core expertise in that area, and they actually have a team of lawyers based in Chicago, or a team of investigators and lawyers based in Chicago that have given them some national coordination. However, at the same time, the SEC also referred the case to the Department of Labor. So the broker-dealer was undergoing a FINRA examination and a DOL investigation at the same time on the same issues, which I think is inappropriate. And we tried to persuade the DOL to back off and let FINRA take the lead, and then we would present the FINRA resolution as a fait accompli to the DOL, and they could agree or disagree, but at least they would know that another experienced regulator looked at it. The DOL refused. They would not back off. They insisted on running a concurrent investigation. The issue is really the waiver of A-share. There's not an assertion that anything else was done wrong, just that the prospectus has said that A-shares, that the front-end loads on A-shares could be waived, and that they should have. And I mention this to point out a couple of things. One, that's the first time I've ever seen the DOL take a position on share classes and the proper application of share classes in an investigation of a broker dealer. And two, I think that it's a good example of the novel issues that are coming up in some DOL investigations now. And then three, just to throw in a third one, I think it illustrates the coordination going on between the SEC, FINRA, and the DOL now, where they're coming together on investment-related issues for retirement plans . So, Brad, I just wanted to point that out as an issue. I don't know if you want to add anything to that or not.
No, I think you're exactly right, and I've been seeing the same things. Also, to a greater extent, seeing the SEC start to identify and assert violations related to ERISA provisions. We're seeing a lot more of the SEC and its investigations sort of, I don't want to say stepping into DOL's territory, but sort of asserting issues there that previously we've not seen them be as bold in asserting. But one last thing on enforcement I want to point out, even though it's not directly on point for, you know, broker-dealers and RIAs, I think it's important to know that this is happening. DOL is making a big push on plan sponsor investigations on missing participants. And so your clients who are being investigated are likely to bring this up to you, but it's also something you should bear in mind to talk to your clients about. If your clients don't have a process for trying to identify and, you know, get in contact with missing participants, particularly those who are coming up on RMD status, it's potentially going to be a problem. DOL is now asking about missing participants in all of its plan sponsor investigations. As best we can tell from what we're seeing, it's now a common question, and they're really quite intent on dealing with it. Hopefully we'll get some actual guidance from DOL about the process they want to see, but in the meantime, they're enforcing this policy through enforcement rather than guidance, and it's becoming an increasing issue we're seeing in plan sponsor investigations.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a national program now, not in writing, but it's in effect. And
yeah.
What I recommend you do on a practical level is get your record keeper's policy on missing participants. Have the plan sponsor get that. Look at it, and then compare it to the DOL's non-enforcement policy on minimum required minimum distributions, RMDs. The DOL says if you follow certain steps, they won't disqualify. I'm sorry, the IRS says if you follow certain steps, they won't disqualify the plan. The DOL won't assert fiduciary breaches. So get a hold of that non-enforcement policy. Get a hold of the policy at the record keeper. Make sure they match up, because as Brad alluded to, your biggest risk is when if the missing participant turns 70 and a half. You know that. It's on the plan records, and you don't make a minimum required distribution. That is a disqualifying defect, and the DOL would assert it was a fiduciary breach. So great warning, Brad. Forewarned is forearmed. Well, Jim Lundy, for all those people who are bored with Department of Labor stuff, let's talk about SEC stuff. And how do you bring us up to speed on your experience with the Share Class Selection Disclosure Initiative? And what do you think people should learn from America having gone through that, about what to look out for in the future? Sure. Thank you, Fred, and thanks, everyone, for joining us today. And I'm happy to jump into that. One thought I want to share, just to echo what you and Brad were discussing, is, you know, that in 12 years, I didn't interact much with the DOL. FINRA, yes, during my 12-year tenure with the SEC. So I naturally expected to do work with Sandy when I joined the firm. And then when I got here, my very first significant SEC enforcement case, for which I represented a client, involved a very aggressive DOL case. And ever since the first month or two when I took on that matter and then got to know you and Brad, I think we are all in discussions in terms of FINRA, SEC, and DOL and ERISA regarding this convergence about fiduciary and best interest standards multiple times a week. And I don't see that changing, particularly with the priority of the current commission and chairman in the retail space. And that's what this initiative was born out of. The priority of Chairman Clayton and this new commission and the shifting of a Wall Street focus to a Main Street focus. And I won't go into the details about the history of the initiative because we talked about that on prior calls, but now that I'm going through it with six clients, there's some lessons that I think are worthwhile sharing with folks. And those lessons include it's going to be a significant and impactful outcome for the entire industry. You know, I don't have specifics, but I know from communications with staff and I know from communications with fellow counsel that hundreds of RIAs of all shapes and sizes self-reported under this initiative. I also know that we're probably not going to have an answer soon. Every RIA who self-reported has been requested to sign and submit a tolling agreement. The first wave of tolling agreements will expire on December 31st. I also know that due to the volume of participants in the initiative from the RIA industry, that unlike the prior initiative, which involved municipal finance issues, we likely will not see one release. The information that I have learned is that there will be several phases, probably three, and that those three waves will then be how the public releases and the settle actions will be issued for all of us to then review. I've also learned that there is experts involved in this particular area that are working very closely with the enforcement staff. I have clients across several different offices. During our initial discussions, you got a sense that they were all kind of looking at this independently. I have since learned that there are regular and periodic educational discussions and expertise sharing across offices of the staff in the asset management unit, such that they are moving forward with a consistent approach for all of these matters. And one thing I can say about the consistent approach is there is no rubber stamping going on whatsoever. They are taking aggressive and critical views of the issues that have been raised by my clients and by other registrants who participated. The approach taken by the vast majority of us was there was a gross number that was submitted, but for a variety of reasons, and we were provided as part of the process a narrative to expand and explain those reasons, certain categories of 12b1 fees that we believe for good faith reasons should be excluded from that gross number to arrive at a net number that my clients and other participants believe is the appropriate disgorgement amount at the end of the day to resolve the matter. That is an intense focus area by the enforcement staff. They are asking appropriate, respectful, but very challenging questions about the analysis behind these categories that were used to make deductions from the gross number. And I'm in the process of going through that right now with multiple clients. And it feels very much like you are in an enforcement investigation as opposed to a cooperative self-reporting initiative. The other takeaway is while this is the second self-reporting initiative, and from an SEC perspective, they are incredibly resource-intensive, I think that these self-reporting initiatives are here to stay. I think the enforcement division and the various specialty units in the division believe in them. I think they believe that they accomplish what they try to accomplish with what I call regulation by enforcement, which is what I believe, in fact, did occur here. But unfortunately, I think we are going to be greeted with self-reporting initiatives like this, you know, every so often in different areas of the financial services world
a year down the road, 2 years down the road, 3 years down the road, but I, for one, will be shocked if this is the last time something like this happens, and I expect it to happen again somewhere in the businesses of RIAs and broker-dealers. So that's kind of where things stand, Fred. We're kind of in a middle point. Like I said, I didn't want to, you know, devote too much time to the history. We've talked about that on past calls. If anyone has any questions about that, I'm happy to have discussions offline. I thought it was important to kind of get a status report. I think there will be more to report on future calls, Fred, as we continue to go through the process. Obviously, a lot to report once we get closer to the finish line and across that line. So, you know, that's my kind of interim report for right now for everyone.
Let me ask you a question about it. I mean, I'm an ERISA guy, and so I come to these SEC activities without a history, which is probably bad because I don't have the proper context, but there's also a good side to it, which is that I'm not burdened by a history, and so I can just see it. And part of my reaction to all of this is that it looks to me like the SEC is significantly ratcheting up their views of the proper disclosures of conflicts of interest and how they need to be disclosed. I mean, because I'm seeing them address some of these issues that I don't remember seeing in the past. I mean, you know, like language in a prospectus or in a ADV that says we may receive revenue sharing, we may receive 1201 fees, we may receive these other types of payments. All of a sudden now it sounds like that's impermissible. You have to do more than that. Is my perspective roughly correct?
Fred, your perspective is exactly correct. And it's incredibly frustrating for clients and for the industry because, like FINRA, when it issues notices, there are platforms for the SEC to do that with their examination alerts that we all monitor and update clients on, like guidance issued by the Division of Investment Management. None of that happened here, not specific to 12b1 fees or specific to the disclosures that you just talked about. So what were well-accepted industry practices 3, 5, 7 years ago have essentially become outlawed by the Enforcement Division. Now, I was just talking to our colleague Andrew Raby, who works in our Investment Management Group, earlier this morning, and essentially the message to the industry, I think, is you should be writing your ADV for the SEC. The idea that it's a quote-unquote brochure and a client-focused document is only going to get you in trouble. You should be thinking that they're going to look at it, they're going to look at it very closely, and they want exact, specific disclosures regarding the material conflicts of interest, and in particular, the financial material conflicts of interest regarding revenue received by the RIA that are related to their recommendations to retail clients. So, Fred, you are exactly correct on that.
Yeah, and you know, not just taking it one step further, Jim, and then we're stealing time from Sandy, but she can have some extra time. Taking it one step further, it seems to me that the SEC is not just saying that your ADV, an RIA's ADV should say, we will recommend funds with 12b1 fees and we will be paid that additional money. But the SEC then expects the ADV to go on and say, and those 12b1 fees will be charged against the mutual fund and reduce your return so that an informed decision can be made by the investor. Again, do you think I'm roughly correct?
I think it's a little more roughly. That's a very, very specific disclosure. But again, I think with the level of scrutiny for which these disclosures and ADVs are being held to, you know, we're going to end up closer to that level of detail, Fred, than where historically the industry has been. I mean, I've made the analogy that much like how public companies in their management disclosure and analysis really writes that for the regulators, and they have a separate glossy document for clients, or pardon me, for shareholders, the ADV should be written with a similar perspective, that it is going to be closely scrutinized. Any generality, use of terms like may, will result not only in findings by the examination program, but a referral and the very real possibility of an enforcement action.
That's great. Thanks very much, Jim. Sorry to drag you out a little bit there. And Sandy, sorry to take the time you need, and we'll still get to the questions. So, Sandy, thanks, Jim. Sandy, let's talk about some of the things you've learned in the broker-dealer world about customer RIAs.
No, don't worry, Fred. I'll be short. So, the topic I was going to address was really what, if any, enforcement proceedings has Springer undertaken with regard to recommendations to roll over 401ks into IRAs in light of one of the exam priorities that existed both in FINRA's letter and in the SEC's letter back in 2014. And just as a brief history, in 2013 there's been a lot of chatter about what was happening with IRAs. So there was an investment company fact book of 2013 that indicated that of the $19.5 trillion in retirement funds, $5.4 trillion of them were in IRAs. And that came on the heel of the Government Accountability Office, the GOA's report that indicated that IRAs participants of 401ks were being recommended to move their assets to IRAs without any real discussion about what the pros and cons of that was. So that, of course, led to FINRA Rule 1345, which said when brokers were recommending rollovers into IRAs, they had to consider certain things and, you know, investment options, fees and expenses, services, penalties, free withdrawals, things to that nature. And later that year, FINRA actually also sent out, in 2014, an alert to investors, sort of giving them warning that before they decided to roll over their 401ks, they really should be evaluating what their transfer options were and looking into what the tax consequences were. But there hadn't been this whole-scale sweep of investigations that I think the industry expected might happen in 2015 or 2016. But there were one-off sort of investigations, mostly into individual brokers and what they were doing in recommending rollovers to their clients. They were things that you would normally expect, like you can't forge the client's signature. But there were other things that were sort of more directly related to the rules. So for instance, in June of this year, 2018, an AWC, which is an acceptance waiver and consent, was entered into by a broker whose name is Ki-Soon Kim, and he was affiliated with Sanlapper Securities. And FINRA, in its fact section, determined that numerous senior customers between 2008 and 2015 had their net worth exaggerated on new account forms because Kim was suggesting that they roll over their 401ks into very speculative stocks. And in order to get them to qualify for the speculative investments, he had to alter their actual financial worth. So it was found to be a violation of the suitability rule 2111, as well as the record-keeping rule 3110, because he had inflated their worth. So that sort of hits directly on what we were expecting from FINRA for this kind of event. Interestingly enough, when you were talking to Brad and even Jim about tying in the DOL into traditional securities regulations, I don't have any personal knowledge of this. I can only report what was presented in the Wall Street Journal, but back in April 2018, earlier this year, and this was attributed, quote, to a person familiar with the inquiry, the Wall Street Journal had reported that the DOL was investigating Wells Fargo for 401k rollovers into what they called were expensive IRAs at the bank. So there again was the DOL sort of stepping into an investigation which you normally would think would fall under the FINRA forum. So I hand it back to you, Fred.
Oh, well, thanks, Sandy, and very interesting. I think there may be a future for you in reporting on rollovers and IRAs and regulatory and examination activity. That ain't going away. Let me go now to some of the pre-submitted questions, and we've already answered some of them. The first one was about DOL guidance for fixing the fact that the fiduciary rule was killed by the Fifth Circuit. Brad talked about it at the beginning, so I think we've answered that one. The second question asks about 401k developments, and I think there are really two. One we've already talked about, which is the open multiple employer plan, multiple employer plans, or MEPs. The other interesting development is student loans. As everybody knows, more and more kids are graduating from college with very large amounts of debt because of primarily the high tuition. And employers are looking at ways to help employees pay off their student loans, or at least some way to let them know they're being supported and that the fact that they may have a lot of debt is understood by the employer, and the employer realizes that it's putting financial pressure on those young employees. And a large company filed for a private letter ruling, and there are rumors about who it was, but the private letter ruling is private. It doesn't say who it was, where the company would say, if you want young employee, it doesn't have to be young, but let me say, if you want young employee, you can pay your student loan, and we will put a matching contribution into the 401k plan for you based on your repayments of the student loan. In other words, rather than having to defer money, the young employee gets the choice of saying, okay, I'll defer and get a match, or I'll pay the student loan and get a match. Now, there's some technical issues there under the Internal Revenue Code, but the IRS resolved them in that scenario on a private letter ruling and was comfortable that it would work. So they gave that company an IRS seal of approval, if you will. The other companies went to their trade association saying, hey, that's a great idea, but our plan's designed a little differently than that, or we want to do it a little differently than that. And so we're not comfortable because that private letter ruling only protects the person who received it, the company that received it. So we want the trade association to go in and get a revenue ruling, which would be of general application and provide protection for everybody who follows its terms. And the revenue ruling would be designed so that there were more options, different ways of designing the program. I'm pretty comfortable that the IRS reasoning would apply across the board, even though it's a PLR. But I think most employers would be a little reluctant to rely on something, particularly for a new approach that doesn't have more universal approval. So I think a lot of people are probably going to wait for the revenue ruling, which I do think will be issued. Meanwhile, I have clients who have hired us to do some other designs for helping employees pay off student loans. So that is an emerging issue. Stay tuned. Brad, I don't want to, cut off your thunder on this one. I know you have some thoughts about it.
Yeah, I'll just say I think it's quite likely the Trump administration is going to give us, as you say, better and more expansive guidance on this. There's a lot of popular support behind this. It's bipartisan. Everybody recognizes the problems with student debt, and I think it's something that we're going to see a lot more activity in. But I agree with you. I think it's a little premature for companies to run out and start setting these up right now. But when that rest of that regulatory framework's in place, I think we're going to see a lot of this.
Paul, we've got a little bit of time for questions. While we answer one more, will you open up the lines and then we'll do one more written question before we actually take verbal questions.
Certainly. Thank you. To signal on the phone lines, please press *1 on your touch-tone telephone. Also, if you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute button is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, *1 on the phone lines for questions, and we'll pause to give everyone the opportunity to signal.
Okay, Brad, let me ask you about state laws. Now, there was a question about could we explain some of the differences in state laws. And probably based on what people have heard, they think there are a lot more state laws that have been finalized than really have. There's one law, that's Nevada, and there's one regulation, and that's New York, that is truly a fiduciary standard. Now, there's other reporting and disclosure laws, but those are the only true fiduciary standards that I can think of that have been finalized. But, Brad, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interest in a lot of states, both at state legislatures and also with state regulators. So there's been discussion and beginnings of movement, but as you say, Nevada passed a law that directs a fiduciary standard for securities, and it does not apply to insurance transactions. Separately, the Nevada insurance regulator has started some sort of best interest question rule about annuities, but it's in the very early stages. So while Nevada has a law on the books, it has no regulation implementing the securities fiduciary standard yet. They're still working on that. And separately, Nevada insurance regulators have started some kind of best interest, but there's no law on it. In New York, we have a best interest standard for annuities and life insurance sales. That is a final regulation which goes into effect next year. Just to quibble with you slightly, New York argues it's not a fiduciary standard, but technically something slightly distinct, a best interest standard. Practically, that's one of the problems with the New York regulation is, well, what does that mean and what limitations does it place on, you know, commissions and so forth. And so there's still a lot of guidance and road to go before the New York regulation gets resolved. New Jersey, as we discussed earlier, has started a regulatory process, but right now it's just a comment-taking process, not even a proposal yet, although we think New Jersey will likely push through to an actual regulation. Now, there's a bunch of other states that are thinking about things. We have Illinois and California, and you know, there have been a variety of other states who've made noises in the state legislature. So I think it's a real risk that we could get a lot more state activity. But it's still sort of in its infancy. And frankly, I think that's one of the reasons the SEC moved forward so quickly after the Fifth Circuit rule struck down the DOL, Fifth Circuit struck down the DOL rule, was for the SEC to reassert its jurisdiction and to try and prevent a bunch of states from acting independently by assuring them that there was a legitimate federal effort going on to address some of these concerns. So I think we are going to continue to see state interest. What's not clear is how widespread it's going to be and whether all of those various proposals get over the finish line. The risk, of course, is we end up with, you know, 30 flavors of best interest in fiduciary that don't all mesh together with the federal standards and make it very difficult to operate on a multi-state basis. That's kind of the worst-case scenario. The hope, I think, is that through the SEC and other actions, we might get to a more uniform outcome and have fewer states jump ahead. But that's kind of the lay of the land, broadly speaking.
Yeah, and to pick up on one thing Brad said, you know, some place, like some states or regulators refer to it as a best interest standard. Some call it a fiduciary standard. A lot of people want to avoid the word fiduciary because it has it is a lot of emotion about the word fiduciary, and in some corners it's a negative emotion. In other corners it's a positive emotion. But if you dig down, if you look under the hood, the New York State rule requires that the insurance agent or a broker act with care, skill, diligence, and prudence, and a duty of loyalty to the insured. If you look at regulation best interest, the SEC proposes to require the broker-dealers act with care, skill, prudence, and diligence, and a duty to the insured. Those are both best interest rules. Well, let's go look at a fiduciary rule. Let's look at Section 404A of ERISA, which requires that an advisor act with care, skill, diligence, and prudence for the duty of loyalty to the participants. In other words, there are all these labels out there, but when you actually look at the definition of the standard, if one is provided, it's not, for example, in the SEC interpretation for investment advisors. They don't use language that defines the standard, but they just say it's a fiduciary standard, so you think it's probably the same thing. So generally speaking, care, skill, diligence, and prudence, and a duty of loyalty, putting the interests of the investor ahead of the interests of the agent or advisor or fiduciary. So it sort of comes down to the same place, with exceptions. I don't want to say that too generally. Operator, do we have somebody on the line?
We do, and we'll take that question, and that will come from Charles Lemaire.
Hi,
hello, Charles.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for the great webinar today. For banks who provide custody-only services to RIA firms, what are what I would call key and main concerns to monitor in light of the current tenor of the DOL investigations of RIA firms?
Say that. I'm sorry, Brad. I didn't catch it. Brad, did you?
Well, Well, if I understood your question, you're saying if we are only a custodian, but we're a bank who's a custodian, do we have an obligation? What should we be worrying about with respect to whether RIAs are properly fulfilling their functions?
Exactly. Exactly. Precisely.
I mean, go ahead, Fred.
I was going to say that you know, some of it depends on how you're classified. For example, even a directed trustee under ERISA can be a fiduciary for the limited purpose of holding and protecting the assets. But as
Correct.
as a custodian, you may be a step further removed than a limited or directed trustee. You may just be a non-fiduciary service provider. If you're a non-fiduciary service provider, you don't have to worry about the co-fiduciary responsibility and liability rules because you're not a fiduciary. That's my quick shoot from the hip analysis. Brad, what do you think?
Well, I think DOL has often taken the position that even a mere custody relationship is still some kind of fiduciary, probably most akin to a directed trustee, where there isn't essentially discretion, but nonetheless some kind of fiduciary obligation. So there might be a co-fiduciary assertion made by someone like DOL. Nonetheless, though, I think you would have pretty narrow exposure there. You'd have to have, I think, more or less actual knowledge that the RIA was doing something wrong that was sort of presented to you that you really had to act on it. I don't think you would have an obligation, for example, to affirmatively try to watch what an RIA is doing. There wouldn't be sort of a monitoring obligation. I think you'd have to confront a very stark problem, something like, it sure looks like these assets are being stolen before
right.
you really
right.
have
like the, like
a lot of obligation.
Right. Kind of a clear, bright line issue. How about if there was some revenue sharing back that maybe wasn't clearly disclosed back to a custodian?
Well, frankly, I'd be concerned about any revenue that's not being disclosed in any kind of potential fiduciary relationship, even in a non-fiduciary service provider relationship. So I would definitely say you should review that and make sure the proper disclosures are being made. Now, whether the disclosure obligation is on you, the bank, or a partner, in other words, are you a subcontractor to someone else for 408B2 purposes, you'd have to actually analyze the service agreement and figure that out. But if you're a direct service yeah. provider, you're definitely going to have to make sure you've disclosed all the direct and indirect compensation.
Right. Exactly. Great. Yeah, Thanks very much, Ben.
I would also, just very quickly, I would also, if I were a plaintiff's attorney or if I were at the DOL, I would say that any service provider that did not disclose part of its compensation became a fiduciary for the purpose of setting its own compensation, because only fiduciaries can determine the compensation of service providers. Now, I mean, arm's length, you can negotiate it, obviously, and you can disclose it, and the trustees can say, okay. But if it's hidden intentionally or inadvertently, I would say there's a risk of an argument that person is setting their own compensation, which is a fiduciary act, and then immediately becomes a prohibited transaction because they're using their fiduciary authority to benefit themselves. So that's a little bit of a convoluted argument, but I think I'd make it if I were on the other side of the case.
Well, I'm pretty sure DOL has made it. Yeah.
Oh, is that right? Oh, okay.
At least in investigations, I'd have to go look, see if they ever actually alleged it in court. But certainly in investigations, they've asserted that undisclosed comp could be a fiduciary breach. But often that would be resolved by, you know, refunding the comp. So maybe, you know, it didn't play out in the final resolution of the case as a breach, but nonetheless it resulted in the money being restored.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Brad, one of the written questions we gotten was, are we ever going to talk about regulatory developments for HSAs? And, you know, so far it hasn't hit my radar screen in terms of something that we could really report on interesting on this call. But I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
I don't anticipate seeing the DOL or IRS doing a whole lot in this space. Now, that said, I've been getting more and more questions about HSAs from different clients and advisors and people I talk to. Because traditionally the HSA side of this sort of grew up through the health insurance side rather than through the retirement advisor side. And I think as it's become a more mature industry, the advisors are saying, well, wait a minute, why aren't we telling people what should be going on with this HSA? Because this is really more akin to a, you know, finance question than it is a health insurance question. And so I think there's been a lot of interest in, is this a new line of business or an expanded line of business advisors should be looking into? But as I said, I don't see a lot of new information coming from the federal government on this. I see it more as just there's an evolving market question. And in terms of how much market there is, I mean, I keep getting different answers from different people I talk to. Some advisors have looked at it and said, yeah, we would want to throw that in as part of our services, and we'd be interested in advising on that. Others have looked at it and said, you know, for most participants, the HSA is being emptied every year as part of their health spend, so there's not really a lot of accumulation. Yeah, I don't know how profitable it actually is as a business line, but we're getting more questions about it, but not from a regulatory perspective, more from a how do we structure this, how do we get involved kind of perspective.
Thanks, Fred. Paula, if somebody's called in, I don't want to cut them off. Is there anybody on the line?
And there are no questions in the queue at this time.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. Well, everybody, as usual, we ran over by a couple minutes, but we like answering your questions because then we know we're really responding to you in the way that you want. So where are we? Well, we're done with the program today. The next one is scheduled for January 24th, 2019. Mark it on your calendar. And thank you so much for being part of this. We really appreciate having you here.